This is Drew Mackey, and you're listening to Singing Mountain. In December 1993, Sega released a fighting game onto the Genesis console and into a market that was utterly saturated with games that featured international casts of combatants kicking the crap out of each other. The game I speak of is Eternal Champions. Now, it's been years since I played this game, but it nonetheless lingers in my memory. For one thing, the game featured two female fighters, Jetta Max, a Russian circus performer, and Shadow Yamato, a Japanese assassin. This is actually pretty rare back in the day. I looked it up. On this one point, featuring more than one female character, the only fighting games I can find that beat Eternal Champions to the punch, so to speak, are World Heroes 2, Super Street Fighter 2, and Sega's own Virtua Fighter, all of which came out just months beforehand. But at the very least, props to Eternal Champions for being one of the first to do that with its inaugural installment, rather than waiting to tack on more female characters in the sequels. If I had to guess why anyone else remembers Eternal Champions, aside from the gameplay itself, or the fact that it was a non-Mortal Kombat fighting game that featured real M for Mature fatalities, I'd say that American gamers might have taken to it because, also like Mortal Kombat, it was created from the ground up by an American team, from the design of the characters to the way the game played to the music. I've said before on this podcast that the majority of the music we heard on Japanese consoles was created by Japanese composers, so when we got something by non-Japanese composers, it had a different vibe to it, a different approach to the subject matter. It's sort of like how you can imagine how certain game companies employ certain composers for long periods of time and end up creating a characteristic sound, like a Capcom sound, a Sunsoft sound, a Nintendo sound, a classic Squaresoft sound. And when someone new works on a soundtrack for one of these companies, you're like, oh, well, this sounds just a little bit different than what I'm used to. That is my theory, anyway. Eternal Champions maybe stuck out from your Fatal Furies and Tekken's and Toshinden's because it looked and sounded more American. I suppose another reason Eternal Champions might stick out in your memory might be if you happen to be a fan of rap music back in the mid-90s. Why? Well, that's kind of a funny story. This is the second installment of a series I'm doing this year on Singing Mountain, where I look into the relationship between video game music and pop music. When I say pop music, I mean everything. Rock and rap and R&B and anything else you might have heard on the radio in the last 20-something years. Some people don't think much of video game music, and especially back in the day video game music. But those people might be surprised to learn how often VGM has influenced pop music. A lot of times this relationship is hard to notice and hard to prove and hard to find in the liner notes for one reason or another, and I'm trying to make that cause and effect a little easier to trace. In the last episode, I built up to a big mystery about how a Janet Jackson track seemed to incorporate a chunk of music from the Square video game Legend of Mana. I regret to say that this mystery continues, though I'll have a note about it at the end of this episode. And while you could probably listen to this episode without having listened to the first installment of this series, episode 56, Michael and Janet in Video Game Land, there are a few things I'm going to gloss over here that I explain in greater depth in that episode, so if you're confused, just go back and listen to episode 56. If I've still got you, have a listen to the title theme from Eternal Champions. The soundtrack to Eternal Champions was composed by five people: Joe Delia, John Hart, Jeff Marsh, Adrian Van Velsen, and Andy Armour. And per my understanding, the soundtrack was compiled in a grab bag fashion, in which Sega would decide which of the submissions would be the one to make it into the game for, say, a certain character's stage. Like, Sega received multiple takes on the stage for Xavier, the game's medieval wizard guy and the character I actually liked best, and then the best one of those made the cut. As near as I could tell, no place online listed the tracks with the precise composers responsible. All five are credited with each track, which made the job of researching this episode slightly harder. See, there were two tracks in particular I needed some background on. In order to find out who among these five composed these two tracks, I had to track down each of them one by one. In order, Jeff Marsh said no, they weren't his. John Hart said no. Joe Delia actually said, "I never worked on a game called Eternal Champions," and then I found the other composer named Joe Delia, who said no, they weren't his. That was kind of confusing. Two guys, both composers, both named Joe Delia, didn't seem to know about each other. Weird. Adrian Van Velsen said I should ask Andy Armour, and finally Andy Armour said, "Yeah, in fact, I did write these songs. Why do you ask?" I was asking because of Bone Thugs and Harmony, the hip-hop group that in 1995 put out its sophomore studio album E Eternal 1999. It topped the Billboard 200 for 2 weeks that August, the Billboard 200 being the weekly ranking for albums, as opposed to the Hot 100, which is Billboard Magazine's weekly ranking of singles. I actually have a physical copy of this album on my kitchen table as I record this episode. I bought it online and it arrived in an envelope, and if you told me a few weeks ago that I, Drew Mackey, would be excited for an old-school jewel case CD Bone Thugs and Harmony album to get mailed to me, I'm not sure I would have believed you. But yeah, as a result of this project, I have now bought more physical albums in 2019 than I did in the last decade. If you open the liner notes, you'll see that songs on this album sample The Dramatics and Earth, Wind, and Fire, for example. And if you look up those songs on databases like ASCAP or BMI, you will see those original songwriters being credited alongside the people who wrote the Bone Thugs songs. You won't see any reference to anyone associated with Eternal Champions, however. And that's weird, because two tracks on E Eternal 1999 really seem to be built on selections from this game's soundtrack. Have a listen to the character bio theme from Eternal Champions, one of the songs Andy Armour identified as his. Thank you. I really like this track, and that morose tone makes a little bit more sense when you understand that the whole thing with Eternal Champions is that all the fighters are dead, and they've been pit against each other for a second chance at life. And now here are the opening 45 seconds or so from a track from the Bone Thugs album, the name of which happens to be Eternal. Before I play, I should probably say that on this one podcast, I make an effort not to swear. On the other two, not so much, but I decided to make this one expletive free. That's not going to work here because this album is a work of gangsta rap, and there is not a way for me to play this song without swears. For the sake of my argument, however, please concentrate on the music.
Where you from, nigga? Straight from the motherfucking land of the hogs. Five true thugs from the double glock, and you fuck. Ready to pop to the dawn, eternally a song. Yeah. Straight mouth up, nigga, return from the clip. Just this hustler, better than I did. We talking about getting distributing, yeah, yo. Little lazy beat it, daily collecting me bankroll, rolling with true. Nothing to lose. Nevertheless, ain't about that talking. Screaming, I murder, coming to serve you. Nigga, we told you, bomb be stalking. Sleepwalking, number one assassin. Pick up the pump and they causing a drug eruption. Let loose with a buckshot blasting. Bone up out of the cut and be bucking. Eternally here to stay.
Not exactly the same, I realize. It sounds like the Eternal Champions melody is being played on a richer sounding instrument than what you would have heard on a Sega Genesis, but that sure as hell sounds like the same melody. Again, Eternal Champions. And again, Bone Thugs.
Where you from, nigga? Straight from the motherfucking land of the hogs. Five true thugs from the double glock, and you fuck. Ready to pop.
Now, here's the other track I was looking into, Bad Ending, also one of Andy's. And here's another track from that same Bone Thugs album, titled Crossroad.
And while I even know you're gone, you still got love on bone. My nigga, just rest your soul.
You hear it, right? Bad ending. And again, Crossroad. One quick aside here. If you know Bone Thugs and Harmony, you might be saying, I know their song Crossroad and what you're playing is not it. I would say you have a lot of attitude. But also, I'd point out that I played the song called Crossroad that comes from the original physical album, which first went on sale July 25th, 1995. It is an elegy to a deceased friend of the band, which might make use of the bad ending theme all the more appropriate. The following March, Eazy-E died, and Bone Thugs remade Crossroad in memory of him, and that version is called The Crossroad, T-H-A Crossroad. It does not feature any parts that sound like anything from Eternal Champions that I can tell. That newer track replaces the original Crossroad on reprintings in the US, and if you look the album up on iTunes today, you will find that you cannot buy the original Crossroad, only The Crossroad, the remake one. And that might seem a little odd, but I'll get to that point a little bit later. I talked to a lot of people to research this episode, including several who work specifically in the field of rights clearance. Some of them work for larger companies that are looking to license music to use in like TV or movies or ads or something, and others are independent contractors who work with artists needing to get the okay to use samples in their music. These people agreed to give me basic background on the whole process without getting into specific instances, which I was cool with because I was just happy to have it all explained to me. Okay, so imagine you're getting ready to record an album, and the album features samples or resung elements or replayed elements from other works. There are people whose job it is to find out who owns the publishing copyright and the master copyright for these referenced works. The publishing copyright is what the songwriter owns, or what that person's publishing company would own. And the latter is the copyright to that specific recording, which would probably be owned by the label for which that artist is recording. It's the difference between the Bangles' performance of the song Manic Monday and the composition of the song, which was actually by Prince. Do people know that? That Prince wrote Manic Monday, generally? Okay, here's a deeper cut if yes. The performance of Red Red Wine by UB40, and the composition of it, which is actually credited to Neil Diamond. Isn't that weird? Red Red Wine is a Neil Diamond song. Seems wrong in my head. Anyway, the person trying to clear these samples reaches out to whoever owns the rights and asks if the artist can use them. If they can use it, a negotiation begins over who gets how much from which pile of money. As it has been explained to me from everyone I asked, this is the process for using samples from anything, including video games, which is to say that no, there don't seem to be any rules that allow video games to be treated differently in these cases than you would be treating like another pop song or the score from a movie. Multiple times, this left me with the same set of questions. So, if there's no credit to a video game composer whose work I am pretty sure is being sampled or otherwise referenced, does that mean I'm wrong? Is it not a sample? Is there no relationship there? Is it coming from somewhere else? Is it a coincidence? Is there any reason neither the composer nor the video game company that presumably owns the rights to the music wouldn't be credited in the liner notes? Or on ASCAP? Or on BMI? Or any official literature I can find related to the song? There are reasons. First, a lack of credit does not necessarily mean a lack of clearance, I am told. A party could just decline to be credited, though I'm unsure why anyone would consent to letting their property be sampled if they, for example, found the derivative work to be obscene or defamatory or otherwise objectionable. I feel like if they felt so strongly about not having their name associated with it, they just wouldn't allow the sample to be used. Second, it is technically possible that the use of the song was cleared on Sega's end, and Sega might have actually received some compensation for its use, but it didn't forward the composer's name to the publisher of the new work. Third, it's possible that Sega just isn't aware that the track sampled something it owns the rights to, though I kind of find this hard to imagine, given that the Bone Thugs album has been out for more than 20 years, and they're a well-known enough group that I feel like most people would recognize that name even if they'd never actually listened to the band's music. Sega is a company with the resources to sue a music publisher if they thought their copyright had been infringed upon, and we do love suing each other in the United States. The fourth possibility is that it just isn't a sample, though I'm fairly certain this is not the case. Because I have ears, and also because I talked to the guy who composed the original tracks. I interviewed Andy Armour over the phone, and he says he remembers holding his son in his lap while sitting in the studio of his apartment in Los Angeles when the melody for the bad ending theme came into his head. He also remembers being paid $500 per composition for his work, and he also remembers signing the contract that said that Sega owns those compositions. Quote, "I was just hired to write it, and as soon as it's written, and as soon as that contract is signed, they own it." They, in this case, means Sega. Another quote. "You know, I don't think they have to credit me. I don't exist. In perpetuity throughout the universe, I don't exist." End quote. That phrase Annie's referring to, throughout the universe in perpetuity, sounds very grandiose, very Galactus destroyer of worlds, I know. But apparently it's fairly standard in contracts where an employee develops intellectual property, like, you know, a song, while being contracted for their services. And I'm certain that Sega would own the Eternal Champions music. And in fact, the work-for-hire contract the composers signed might say that technically speaking, legally speaking, Sega is the author of those songs. However, I'm not sure that Andy is correct in saying that he, as a songwriter contributing to the Eternal Champions soundtrack, doesn't exist in perpetuity throughout the universe. He is credited in the game itself, in the end credits, along with the other four guys. They don't spell his name correctly, or Adrian Van Velsen's for that matter, but they are saying, hey, this is who made the music. Just in case you're getting the wrong idea, Andy doesn't sound super angry about the situation and wasn't clamoring for money. And it might be underselling it to boil it down to, well, a credit would be nice, but that is essentially what's going on here, because songwriting credits are useful in this world for getting subsequent work, and that might have been handy back in 1995. He told me he found out about the connection with Bone Thugs a few years ago and just ended up commenting on some YouTube clips, saying in effect, oh, I actually wrote that. The response was positive. So, quoting Andy here, "I was getting these amazing comments from random strangers. Like, you know, you changed my life. That song was on my clock radio. That's the reason I play guitar." And when Andy was relating all these things to me, there was this satisfaction in his voice, the kind of satisfaction you hear from a creative person who has observed that his work has connected with an audience. I would guess that one reason Armor wishes his work on those two Eternal Champions tracks got some credit on the Bone Thugs album is that he co-wrote this 1979 Herb Alpert disco instrumental called Rise. You might be thinking this sounds familiar and you can't quite put your finger on why. If you're around my age, it's probably because of the part of the song you hear at 3 minutes and 9 seconds. There it is. Yes, Rise attained its own level of prominence at the time, but got new prominence in 1997 when the Notorious B.I.G. track Hypnotize sampled Rise and therefore got Andy a songwriting credit on that track. That was the last track Biggie released before he died. Literally, he was gunned down a week later. Having a credit on a song like that means something. We were talking about it, and Andy told me this. There have been a few times when I had fun pulling that out at a music store and going, yeah, look, there's my name. Isn't that weird? I totally get it. I used to work for print publications, and there was always something cool about seeing my byline in print, even if it was all the words below that byline that actually mattered. It was a point of pride. In talking to music industry people, I've been encountering a recurring problem, and the problem is the website whosampled.com. The previous episode, I talked about the phenomenon of people hearing two songs and concluding one ripped off the other without investigating whether both songs are just using a common musical structure that is unique to neither, or if perhaps the melodies are just similar but not necessarily the same. Whosampled.com is a database of song meta relationships. Samples, covers, remixes, and other forms of musical quotation. If you like music, it is a wonderful hole to fall down into. And it's helpful for my research, but because the connections are submitted by users, you should treat it like you treat Wikipedia. a jumping off point for further research, but something you cannot necessarily trust at face value. The people I talk to are well aware of this site, and also well aware of the fact that it can be unreliable sometimes. And when I pointed out the similarity between the Eternal Champions tracks and the Bone Thugs tracks, I got more than one variation of, "Oh, did you find this at whosampled.com?" I did not, for what it's worth, and regardless, before I bothered anyone about it, I researched this as much as I possibly could. Of the people I talked to, the one who was the most helpful was the one who listened to the tracks while we were talking on the phone, and by the way, immediately concluded, "Oh, well, that's just blatant." This person told me the next step in the investigation should be for the composer to reach out to Sega with the following questions. Were these derivative works? Did Sega give sample clearance for them? And did the company release the sample for gratis? Because I'm curious, I reached out on Andy's behalf to the precise person who would oversee such matters now, along with the note that I realized that this whole thing happened about 20 years ago, but perhaps you might know someone who knows someone. I have yet to receive a response, though I will append any new information to future installments of this series. I suppose a smart person listening to this weird little story might be wondering if I reached out to someone from the record label, the Bone Thugs record label, to ask what their take might be. I did, as a matter of fact. The very person in charge of clearing samples for the album. Here is a dramatic recreation of how our exchange went. "Hi, my name is Drew, and I'm doing a research project. I understand you oversaw sample clearance for E Eternal 1999. Can I ask you some questions?" This person: "Sure, I'd love to help." Me: "Okay, well, all my questions are about this 1993 Sega game called Eternal Champions. Can you tell me if any material from the game was cleared for use?" No response. Me again a few days later: "Hi, it's me. I'm still trying to get some info about the production of this album. Are you interested in talking?" This person: "Sure, what do you need to know?" And I respond with, "So all of my questions are about Eternal Champions," and no response. I actually reached out several more times, and they never told me that they weren't going to talk to me. They just declined to answer my questions. My inner Mulder always wants to leap to some conspiracy theory and think some valuable information is being purposely withheld from me, but I'm actually fairly Scully dominant in these situations, and here are all the explanations I can think are more likely. This person doesn't remember. This person doesn't care. This person isn't at liberty to speak about this specific subject because they probably signed a non-disclosure agreement back in the day. And this person has, like, a family and real work they're trying to do today and hobbies and 100 more pressing things to do than talk to some nerd for his video game music podcast. I do realize that I'm this little wiener kid cold calling strangers and being like, "Hi, will you talk to me about this video game that came out 20 years ago?" When you're asking that of someone who doesn't think about video games on an hour-to-hour basis, I guess it seems like a pretty big request. Hearing me explain all this, you might think that I feel like the members of Bone Thugs did something wrong in using these samples. I don't, at all. I actually think what happened here is kind of genius, or at least the kind of pop culture spanning creativity I really enjoy. The group wanted to write a song in memory of a friend who died, and they did that by incorporating the bad ending theme, music from a fighting game that signifies an outcome of a playthrough that is undesired. In doing this, Bone Thugs used an element of the pop culture vernacular, fighting games were everywhere in 1995, to connect with their audience, a significant segment of which probably would have played Eternal Champions and would have known what that music meant. It's actually pretty clever, and in a way it gives the original composition a new layer of complexity. As artists, the guys in Bone Thugs did their job, which is to make art. The detective work around those samples is, as I explained earlier, someone else's job, and it would have been all in the up and up if, per that contract, Sega was not obligated to attach Andy's name to the music. If that's our answer, then we're looking at a dumb failing of the system that's supposed to assure artists they get credit for their creative efforts. Which is a bummer. But I still want to know why there's no reference to at least Sega or Eternal Champions anywhere. No matter who is the legal author of these songs, they were still sampled. Did Sega decline to be credited? Why would they? And why does it seem like video game music is treated differently in these situations, even if everyone is telling me that that is not the case? In case you're wondering why the original Eternal Champions sampling version of Crossroad got cut out from later versions of the album, I'm gonna scully you once again. I don't think anyone was trying to cover up a non-sanctioned sample or anything. The remake was a hit, while the original wasn't even a single. So I would bet good money that it was actually a business decision to swap one song out for the other, though I guess it is kind of weird that the original version got struck entirely. But I don't work at a record label. What do I know? A few months before E-Eternal 1999 came out, Eternal Champions got a sequel on the Sega CD, Eternal Champions Challenge from the Dark Side. It features none of the original five composers, but at the very least, it does double down on the number of female fighters. If you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you know that this is very important to me. Beyond Jetta Max and Shadow Yamato, it adds Riptide, a female pirate, and Raven, a voodoo priestess who I'm pretty sure is the first black female character ever in a fighting game. Sega also put out two spin-offs, one starring Shadow and the other one starring the gangster cat burglar fighter Larson Tyler, and then never revisited the franchise. Again, bummer. Andy Armour did compose music for a lot of subsequent games, including the Sega Saturn title Three Dirty Dwarves, which he mentioned specifically while we talked, and which I'll link to in the show notes. He also worked on Echo the Tides of Time, composing what I think are some of the game's better tracks. Have a listen to that game's title theme for a glimmer of what else Andy was capable of doing with a Sega Genesis. That is it for now. That is the limit of what I can tell you about the Eternal Champions, Bone Thugs, and Harmony connection. And I guess that it might be another unsatisfying conclusion, but like I keep saying, this is an ongoing project, and I will update when I get answers. Before all the end of episode stuff, though, I can give you this. Like I said earlier, I haven't come up with a solution to the big mystery in the previous installment of this series. How this 2001 Janet Jackson song seemed to contain a loop sample from the 1999 game Legend of Mana. Two people now have suggested to me that the music featured in these songs might be gamelan, a percussion-forward style of traditional Indonesian music. It sounds like this. The thing that taught me about this style of music is actually the predecessor to Legend of Mana, Secret of Mana. This game's go-to spooky music is titled Ceremony, and it's been compared to gamelan by a few people writing about it online. Thank you. It should be noted that Secret of Mana was composed by Hiroki Kakuta and Legend of Mana by Yoko Shimomura. And the presence of gamelan-inspired music in one composer's body of work doesn't mean it's necessarily in the others. But it's possible it might be. As it was pointed out to me, it's possible that both the Legend of Mana track and the Janet Jackson track might be riffing off a piece of music that's very common in gamelan. I tried to find out if this might be true, but no one I've talked to so far has recognized it. Do you know anyone who knows about this style of music? Because if you do, hook me up. Please. You might remember in the other episode that the mashup between Ice Cap Zone from Sonic 3 and the song that allegedly inspired it needed very little adjustment to overlay perfectly on top of each other. That made me curious to see how much fudging, tempo-wise, it would take to make the Janet Jackson and Legend of Mana music match up. It didn't take much. I only had to speed the Legend of Mana track up by 2 seconds, and it sounded pretty much dead on. I don't know if that means anything, but in light of this episode, I'd like to think it might. For each installment of this series, I'm posting the text at singingmountainpod.com, including clips and any relevant sources I used. As always, you can listen to all previous episodes of Singing Mountain at singingmountainpod.com, but also anywhere else you'd normally find a podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or criticisms, the easiest way to reach me is on Twitter, either at Drew G. Mackey, M-A-C-K-I-E, or at Singmopod, S-I-N-G-M-O-P-O-D. You can also follow Singing Mountain on Facebook. Search for Singing Mountain and then click on the one that is not a bakery. And if you like pixel art, Singing Mountain is on Instagram at Singing Mountain Pod. Please subscribe, and if you like the show, please give me a rate and review, because those are helpful for the reasons you hear on every podcast ever. The show is written, produced, and edited by me, Drew Mackey. The cover art for this series of episodes examining VGM and pop music was designed by Jude Buffum, a pixel artist whose work I really dig. You should check his stuff out at judebuffum.com, JudeBuffum.com. I would like to thank Amy Smith, Ryan Felix, and Clarissa Way for their help in getting this episode done. Singing Mountain is a Table Cakes podcast. Table Cakes is a Los Angeles-based podcast network that features some really cool shows, including two other ones that I host. Check them all out at tablecakes.com. If you would like to support Singing Mountain or any of the shows on the Table Cakes network, please do so at patreon.com/tablecakes. I know I normally wrap up an episode with something that summarizes the topic at hand, but instead, this time I'm going to end with a preview of a track I'm focusing on in the next installment of this series. The Elecman theme from the first Mega Man, composed by Manami Matsumae. Why? Because I'm hoping to get to the bottom of a mystery I can actually solve. See ya.